I'd like to introduce Rabbi Levine. He is the rabbi of our local Orthodox synagogue in Willow Glen called Amichad. He's been a rabbi there since 2007, where he's unified the community and grown it substantially through that time. Before that, well, he was originally born in Miami. And after attending yeshiva in both the U.S. and in Israel, he actually attended law school at the prestigious Ivy League school at Penn. But even there, he was pushing Yiddishkeit. He actually started a group, Jewish Heritage Club, where he got some Jewish students together and increase their level of Jewish knowledge. So after that, he came to Amichad, and you know, I've known him for a few years, but I really got to know him the last year and a half after I started going to Amichad on a daily basis to say Kaddish for my dad, a blessed memory. And he's been, Rabbi Levine has been a great inspiration for me since that time. I've been greatly inspired by his drashes and his classes. I actually took a class from him even earlier this morning. Rabbi Levine, all four of his grandparents are Holocaust survivors. So I'm looking forward to what he has to say today. He actually also has seven children. So, you know, what could be greater revenge on Hitler than that? So with that, Rabbi Levine.
Okay, thank you very much, Russ. I am Rabbi Levine. I know a few people here. But just to give you a little bit of background before I speak about how the Holocaust impacted me in particular, I think you heard about that I went to multiple yeshivas. I have a law background. I actually get questions around the Bay Area from many of the rabbis because of my rabbinic and law background as well. But pertinent to today, all four of my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. My father's parents were the lucky ones. My father's parents were Polish Jews, and in 1940, they had the privilege of being exiled to Siberia. Many of their siblings, all of my great-grandparents did not have that privilege. They all died in the Holocaust. My father's parents were still single. They met in Siberia. My grandfather, all four of my grandparents, I was lucky. My bubbies and zaydis, my sabas and safas, I grew up in Miami Beach. They were there. And I remember looking at my grandfather's feet as a little boy and seeing they're all blue. They had been frostbitten from his days in Siberia. But relatively speaking, they survived because 1940... they refused Russian citizenship when Russia took over their part of Poland, and they were sent to Siberia, and that's why they lived. I mean, some of their siblings, all of their parents, cousins, all were killed in the Holocaust. My mother's parents were not that lucky. They were in the German side of Poland in 1939. They lost their entire family. My mother grew up with no grandparents, no cousins, no aunts, no uncles, siblings, nothing. Both of my mother's parents were married to different spouses before the Holocaust. They both lost their first spouse in the Holocaust. My mother's father, my Zayda Reuven, he actually saw his first wife and two kids shot in front of his eyes. I'll just tell you very briefly, just to get a picture. They had a hiding place where they were hiding from the in Poland in a house, and the Nazis surprised them, and they all ran to that hiding place. My Zayda got in. His first wife would still have the kids, and they shut the door. And through the cracks, he saw the Germans come in with about 10 other people in that area. They held his mouth, someone next to him, and he saw literally his wife and two children murdered. This Zayda hid in a pit for a year where a pole fed him. He ended up with the Belsky brothers in the forests. My mother's mother, who also was married before the war, was in a ghetto. She, my Bubby Miriam, who's still alive, she's 103 years old. 103. She spoke perfect Polish. She grew up Hasidic. Her brothers only spoke in Poland, they spoke Yiddish. They had no shot to hide. She was blonde, blue. She actually at one point worked in a Nazi soup kitchen. She said her biggest nightmare for years was that she would speak Yiddish in her sleep, and they would know that she's a Jew. She was sleeping with Germans and Poles for over a year. And eventually my mother's parents met in the DP camps. When you talk about Polish Jewry, that makes certainly my mother's side a miracle. Of course, Poland, the general government of Poland, had over 3.3 million Jews in 1939. Of those 3.3 million Jews, 3 million plus were murdered. And of the 3 million plus that were murdered, there were 300 some odd thousand that survived. Over 270,000 of those survivors were like my father's parents in Siberia. Less than 100, so mostly about, most estimates say 50,000 Polish Jews survived the 3.3 plus million Jews coming into the Holocaust. Growing up in such a family impacted me with grandparents around me. So I grew up with all four of my grandparents being survivors. I myself, my Hebrew name, my name I go by, is Menachem Mendel Chaim. Menachem Mendel was my great-grandfather on one side. Chaim was on the other side. All of my siblings have two or three names. We were all named after, my parents never knew how many children they were going to have. We were all named after great-grandparents, great-uncles, great-aunts. Every one of my siblings have two names because we were named after, there were just not enough names to go around. And I grew up with grandparents. One of my grandparents, my Baba Miriam, told me everything all the time. She thought it was the biggest mitzvah. I knew every single story. I could write her biography. She was interviewed by Spielberg. She has hours of, my grandfather, who saw his wife and two kids shot, never, ever, ever spoke about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. I never heard a word from him. If I didn't know it from my grandmother, I would have never known anything. Mm-hmm. He never talked about it. But I heard the stories from my grandmother. He never talked about it.
How many siblings do you have?
I'm one of five. And they all have, I have seven. All my siblings have a lot. I came today, I have a little list of multiple topics to how it affected me. It propelled me to be a rabbi to help what I view as a spiritual Holocaust today. Right? I would say it gave me a feeling of, you never know what's best. Look at me. I exist because my mother's parents got married after the war. They're married to somebody else, right? The divine plan, for whatever reason, is my mother's parents married each other. They would have never, right? I was with somebody recently. I get to meet with all kinds of Jews. I'm an Orthodox rabbi, but I would say most of my lunches during the week are with not observant Jews. I have a large congregation of Russ, Kegatel, Spurgman, but so a guy tells me, why is the Holocaust? How could it got? So I said, I just want to tell you one thing. Most likely, if it wouldn't be a Holocaust, it wouldn't be a state of Israel. Almost definitely, I would say. There'd be no state of Israel. No way would the state of Israel come into existence without a Holocaust. Does that justify the Holocaust? No. But you just have to understand there's so much divine plan. I always grew up thinking of my own self, I would not be here. A person never knows. That's how I thought that a lot as a kid, that there's a divine plan. I always grew up in, I think Judaism I'm sure if we took opinions about many things in Judaism, in this room we'd have very different opinions, right? We'd all have strongly different opinions about certain things. But you know what? I at the end of the day, we were all gas together. We're all Jewish together. We're one people together. And I always grew up with that feeling that we're one nation. That at the end of the day, our enemies don't distinguish between different types of Jews. And we shouldn't. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have our differences and opinions and philosophies. But at the end of the day, we always have to know we are one nation. Right? If our enemies know that, we need to know that. We are Am Echad. I'm not promoting my shul today. But we are Am Echad. I also learned the importance of not judging. Not only did I grow up in Miami with four Holocaust survivor grandparents, but I grew up every day seeing Jews put on tefillin with numbers in their arm. Miami Beach, Florida, they used to call Miami Beach Jewish heaven. So all the Jews came to retire. Everyone from New York and Chicago. So you had a huge population in South Beach used to be of Yidden, of Jews who were 70, 80, 90 years old who lived in the Northeast and came to Miami to retire, and many of them were survivors. So as a young boy, I would see many people with numbers on their arms. I'll never forget. I was, I think, 18 years old. It was Shabbat. And I was walking on the street in Miami Beach. Anyone heard of Ron Dermer, who's the ambassador to currently? So David Dermer, when I was, his brother was the mayor of Miami Beach a few years ago. His father, Jay Dermer, was the mayor of Miami Beach. Miami Beach is very Jewish. It's very Jewish. It has a huge Orthodox population, it has a huge conservative. It's a very Jewish area. So I remember I was walking in Miami Beach. There's multiple synagogues all over the place. And a lady stops me. She says, "Come here." And it was Saturday afternoon, and she's waiting by the bus stop. She looks at me in the eye, and she tells me, "My brothers looked like you." I'm wearing a black hat. "They looked like you in Vienna, and they all died in the Holocaust." They all died in the Holocaust. And she tells me that her granddaughter is marrying an army, a non-Jew, in a few weeks, and she doesn't care. Because she doesn't want him to die like her brothers died. And she warned me. And she warned me that I have to watch out in my life as well. Because I look like the way I look. But you know what? I grew up with all kinds of Holocaust stories. And I always said to myself, I can never judge. You know what they went through. Right? The stories that I heard as a little boy. I heard and I still hear today. You don't judge. You learn not to judge people until you went into their surroundings. I had a few topics I wanted to embellish on, but I looked at the crowd today. I look at this crowd, this obvious crowd today. We have survivors. We have second generation. We have third generation survivors. We have the future. We have young girls who are coming to connect to Yahudut, to survivors, to people before them. And many of these young girls I can see come from Sephardic backgrounds, not Ashkenazi. Am I correct about that? Some, right? But we're all in it together over here. So I want to just take on one topic. I was going to speak of multiple topics. I want to pick one that I'm going to focus on, actually based on this week's Parsha. What's this week's Parsha? This past week. What did we read? Pukudei. This past week on Shabbos, we read Parshas Pukudei. You can take my seat, by the way. It's open. Pukudei. Yeah. So Pukudei is the last Parsha in all of Seder Shmot. Shmot is Exodus. The last Parsha in all of Shmot is Pukudei. And you know how Pukudei ends? It talks about the Anani HaKavod. Who wants the Anani HaKavod? I don't know what the Anani HaKavod is. Clouds of glory. So we know when the Torah tells us that when the Jewish people were in the desert for 40 years, they had clouds of glory. They had Anani HaKavod. It's Ashkenazi. I'll translate to Ibrit afterwards. It had Anani HaKavod going with him. This is how the Torah ends. Uvahalois ha'anan mi'al ha'mishkon yisu b'nei Yisrael b'chol ma'aseihem v'im lo ya'al ha'anan v'lo yisu ad yoyim ha'laso ki'anan adra ha'mishkon yom va'esh tiyel la'la bo le'eni kol beis Yisrael b'chol ma'aseihem. when the cloud was raised up from the tabernacle is the Mishkan. What was the Mishkan? The tent where the ark was kept. Eventually, the Mishkan would become the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. So the Mishkan, which is the tabernacle, they would have a cloud to teach with the Jewish people. There are 3 million Jews in the desert. The clouds would go, and that's where the Mishkan would follow. Wherever the clouds go, the Mishkan would follow. But the last verse says as follows. For the clouds of Hashem, of God, would be on the Mishkan, the tabernacle, by day, and then the clouds of fire by night. Before the eyes of the whole house of Israel, throughout their journeys. For the 40 years. Which is a remarkable thing, because the previous verse said, when the Jewish people journeyed, the clouds were not over them. When they rested, the clouds were over them. Yet, the clouds are called going over them with their journeys. So, which in theory should be a contradiction. The foremost commentator on the Bible is who? Who's the foremost commentator? Tanakh. Rashi. Who knows? Anyone? Where's Rashi from? Anyone know?
France.
Rashi, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, was the leading Ashkenazic. If you talk all Ashkenazic Jewry, the house of Rashi, they show today, by the way, more than 50% of Ashkenazic Jewry comes from the house of Rashi. More than 50%. The Bali Tosus, 11th century Rashi's family, the Tosus, more than 50% of Ashkenazic Jewry come from Rashi. I'm not from Rashi, at least on my father's side, because Rashi came from, was a direct descendant of King David. My last name is Levine, I'm a Levite. So I know I'm not from Rashi. But many, many of us in this room, whether we realize it or not, are actually at some level descendants of Rashi. Maya told me she's a Luria. She's from the Arizal. You may also be from Rashi, right? Many of us are from Rashi. Rashi, what does Rashi say on this pasuk? How is it it says that the clouds were over us when we journeyed? Zakt, Mr. Gan, Zakt explains Rashi. Wherever they traveled, the clouds of glory were above them. Rashi then says, it says that when they traveled, the clouds were in front of them. Then Rashi says, it explains as follows. Makom chiniyasan, af hu karay masai, masa. That the place where they encamped, that's also called a journey. That even when they encamped, it was called a journey. Even where they encamped, they called it a journey. And that is because in life, sometimes we have to realize all of life is a journey. Everything in life is a journey. But even when we're encamped, the essence of a Jew, the essence of a Yid, the essence of a Yehudi, is to realize we are on a journey. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who is the previous chief rabbi of England, actually won this year's Templeton Prize, which is the biggest prize a religious leader could win. He makes a remarkable comment on this Rashi. He had a piece that actually came out this week. Judaism is a journey, not a destination. Rabbi Sacks says as follows, talking about this Rashi. He says, the point is linguistic. But the message of this Rashi, that even where camped is a journey, is remarkable. In a few brief words, Rashi has summarized an existential truth about Jewish identity. To be a Jew is to travel. Judaism is a journey, not a destination. Even a place of rest, an encampment is called a journey. The patriarchs, who are the patriarchs?
Abraham, Isaac.
The Avot, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, lived not in a house, but in tents. Right? The first time we were told that a patriarch and Av, Yaakov, built a house, proves the point. It says, the Torah tells us in Bereshit, that Yaakov traveled to Sukkot. There he built himself a house and made shelters for his livestock. That's why we call the place Sukkot. The verse is astonishing, okay?
There's a seat over here. I don't know if there's a seat over here.
Okay.
I don't know where Russ is. We're interrupting him.
Yes. How long is he going to talk?
Half an hour.
Okay.
15 more minutes.
Is he taking questions?
I don't know. Are you taking
questions? I will. At the end, I'll take all questions.
Okay.
I hope I take questions. So Rabbi Sacks is as follows, that if we, the way we live in this world is we're supposed to live as life is a journey. And we're not ever supposed to say we're done. To quote Emmanuel Levan, it's I am a stranger, to be a Jew is to stay light on your feet, ready to be in the next stage of a journey, literally or metaphorically. An Englishman's home is his castle, they used to say, but a Jew's home is a tent, a tabernacle, a sukkah. We know life on this earth is a temporary dwelling. That is why to view life, every moment of life as temporary and life as a journey, creates every moment being new and newness. And you know who he brings as an example? He brings a Holocaust survivor, somebody who passed away very recently. His name is Lord George Wiedenfeld. Has anyone ever heard of Lord George Wiedenfeld? He was in the news recently. Lord George Wiedenfeld, like the Weiss family, was a Jew who, in 1938, though, from Vienna, when Anschluss was when the Nazis took over Austria, and they brought the Nuremberg Laws within weeks to Austria, when Anschluss happened, George Wiedenfeld escaped at the age of 18 from Vienna, and ended up in London. He ended up in London. And he ultimately became a very, very famous publisher, a very wealthy Jew. He was an advisor to Chaim Weizmann. Who's Chaim Weizmann? First president of Israel. Right? President for Chaim Weizmann, and he lived a life where he was an advisor, he was a leader for many people. So George Wiedenfeld, the last thing he did this past year before he passed away, is George Wiedenfeld sponsored 20,000 Iraqi Christians to come into London, and he said the reason he sponsored these 20,000 Iraqi Christians is because he himself was a survivor, and he felt a debt of gratitude that he was taken and survived in London. He felt a debt of gratitude to bring other people in. He was asked, George Wiedenfeld was asked shortly before he passed away, right? Why is he so active? He's in his 90s. He passed away this year at the age of 96. So that's why he was so active. He told the Times of Israel, who asked him this question, as follows. When you get to your 90s, you begin to see the door about to close. He said, I have so much to do before the door closes. And the older I get, the harder I have to work. That's the message for staying young. That's the way a Jew lives. That no matter what age you are, no matter where you come from, no matter what you're doing, that a Jew is constantly pushing themselves to go to the next step. Do you know who, this actually came out this week, there's 7.5 billion people in the world approximately, more than 3.5 billion men in the world. Who is the oldest man in the world? That's right. This week it was announced that the oldest human being, over 3.5 billion people in the world, the oldest man in the world is a man named Yisrael Kastel. He's an Orthodox Jew who lives in Haifa. Let me tell you about this Yisrael Kastel. He is 112 and a half years old. 112 and a half years old. He is the old figure. A lady lives longer than a man. There's a lady in America who's 116. But Mr. Kastel is 112. Let me tell you how he lived. He was born in 1903 in Poland. He says as a young boy, he was in Galicia, he saw Franz Josef, who is the head of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, ride through his town. He remembers seeing Franz Josef. He went to Łódź, or called Łódź. He ended up in Łódź. It's Franz Josef. And he got married. He had two kids. And the Holocaust started in 1939. He was put in the Łódź ghetto. Does anyone know who the head of the Łódź ghetto was? Well, before that, who the Lodge Ghetto, does anyone know? He's a famous person. Chaim Rumkowski. He was in the Lodge Ghetto with Chaim Rumkowski until 1943. In 1943, he got sent to Auschwitz. He lost his wife and his two kids. When he was liberated by the Russians in 1945, this man weighed 82 pounds. 82 pounds. And today, over 70 years later, he's married, he has a kid, he has many grandchildren, and many, many great-grandchildren. And he is the oldest living person in the entire world.
He passed away.
Oh, he's alive. No, they took pictures this week. He's alive. He's alive.
It was in the Israeli
papers. The international papers.
Yeah, okay.
International papers. Yeah, sure. So just very briefly. So he's 112 plus Israel. They asked his daughter, tell us about your father. His daughter's in the 90s. He asked his daughter, or late 80s, tell us about your father. You know what she said about her father? She said the following about her father. She said that her father never walked around negative after the Holocaust. He lost everything. He lost his first wife and two children. He lost his parents, his siblings, his livelihood. He was in Auschwitz. He was always optimistic, always positive, and always believed in God. That's what she said about his father. Never looked back at the past. Always positive, always optimistic, and always believed in God. It reminded me of my own grandmother, my own Bubby, who today is 103 years old. My Bubby, my grandmother, I never heard her speak. She always told me in the past, I never spoke her negative. I'm going to tell you something remarkable. My mother when she grew up, had two wood figures that she used to have, an old man and old lady.
Yeah.
And she used to put it on top of the television and imagine that was her grandparents. Mm-hmm. She never knew what her grandparents looked like. All my mother knew as growing up as a girl was that her grandparents, her and all of her aunts and uncles were killed. She never knew anything. But you know what my Bubby always said? She's 103 now. She's the last year become had dementia, unfortunately. She told me one thing always. She told me one thing always. Always say, Baruch Hashem Yom Yom. Thank God for every day. Appreciate every opportunity in life. Love every single day of life. She told me this message over and over and over. Baruch Hashem Yom Yom. Thank God. Appreciate the blessing of every day. And that's why I grew up normal. And that's why my parents grew up normal. Because at the end of the day, my grandparents, after the Holocaust, built. They didn't mourn the rest of their lives. They went ahead and said, a Jew, you got to build in this world. You got to live in this world. Never to look at anyone who didn't. But really the essence that I grew up with in growing up with grandparents in the Holocaust is you thank God for the blessings you have. You welcome the opportunities you have. And if a person has that perspective, then we build a future Jewish people. Right? We look what we can give. When I see a crowd like this today, when you see children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, people who survived giving over their knowledge, their lives to others, that is Baruch Hashem. We thank Hashem that these girls who are turned by mitzvah or just turned by mitzvah are able to see people who lived through the Holocaust and are there to tell it. So I say, Baruch Hashem, Yom Yom, thank you for inviting me to today. It is a privilege to be with people who memorialize what was important, but who not only memorialize what was important, but build for a great and beautiful and fantastic Jewish future. Okay, any questions? I said very briefly, but any questions? You had a question, you said?
Yeah, I have some questions.
Okay.
I was born 81 years ago in Hungary, Budapest. So I am pushing 82 years old. And I am Karura. I'm mixing in. I lived 10 years in Sweden. I left Hungary in 1966. I lived under Nazis. I lived under communists. The Nazis killed us, and the communists didn't let us live. There were many Jews among the communists. Some of them were opportunists. Others were, I don't know, but they believed in it. As Jews, we know that Marx, Engels, they came up with a new religion. Communism is a religion, right, for the communists. In Germany, Hitler was a god. Those who believed in Nazism, Hitler was the Führer. And Stalin in Russia wasn't a Russian. He was a Georgian, and he was a god for the communists. Okay, Lenin started it. Now, I am as relevant as you are. So I want to give my background. And I have a question. Yes, I have a question. Where in the Torah is the 3 million who left Egypt? I never heard that there were 3 million Jews wandering in Egypt. That's one question. Please answer.
Okay. So very briefly, that was just the question, 3 million? So the Torah says that there are 600,000 men, from the ages, that's explicit, multiple places in the Torah. It's actually how Bamidbar starts, it's how in Shemosh, so a couple places, in Exodus, and in Numbers. There's 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. 60. But ages 20 and 60. So the it's extrapolated. If 20 is 600,000 men, so double that, this is 1.2 million for the ladies. And there's at least, I was very conservative, at least 2 kids per family. So probably more than 3 million. But the we say 3 million just to be safe. Good question. Is there anything? Yeah?
600,000 in Egypt before
the Torah says it's 600,000 men ages 20 and 60. Actually talks about, that's the army age. That's what it says. So that's about over 3 million. Yeah. Anything else?
I just want to say that the year of experience, my mother and father were both in Auschwitz. My mother's 96 and walking around, and she can talk a lot about the experience that you just gave everyone. But she would prefer really not to talk. My parents, like almost all the people I knew who were in the camp, they never really wanted to talk to their children about their experience. It was really only later in life, because they were optimistic. They did not want to burden us growing up about their experience.
Right.
And it's really interesting, because my kids now, who are 35 and 33, I see the weight of what they went through on their shoulders, because they dream about it, they think about it, they write about it, they write essays about it. So it's kind of a similar, I think it's a similar
background. Yeah. So I'll just, on that comment, there's two points. I know one of the greatest psychotherapists in New York, his name is Yaakov Solomon. He wrote, I never told me this, but he's close to my family. He wrote an essay a few years ago to thank his father. To thank his father. Why did I ask to thank his father? His father was in Auschwitz. He actually, in the summer of 1960, disappeared for 2 months. He had no idea why. He found out later that his father went to testify against Eichmann. He said he never, his father, he knew his father was a survivor. But his father, when he read his father's testimonies, he said he thanked his father for being able to play baseball when he was a little kid, not worrying about that could happen to me. At the same level, this week, international news again, Dustin Hoffman. Anyone see this?
Yeah.
Dustin Hoffman was interviewed for Roots, and they had told him that his great-grandmother, who was a Russian person who was in the Nazis, was in a concentration camp and how she survived. And Dustin Hoffman said, he grew up with no Judaism, no Yiddishkeit, no Yahadut at all. He knew his parents were Jewish. He had no Yom Kippur, no Pesach, no nothing, zero. And he said he had such regret that he never knew anything about his Judaism. So it's a very fine balance, right? We want to be optimistic about the future. We don't want to have to live in the past, but at the same time, it's important that these girls and we know about what happened before so that we can both inculcate it and make good decisions on it. Anything else? Yes.
I am 85, so of course I overcome the board completely. The first day. My part of my family, four of us, escaped Odessa when it was already surrounded by sea. My grandparents, my uncle, my all family was killed in Odessa.
Wow.
My grandparents from father's side was deeply Orthodox, deeply. I hardly could see. Whenever I would come, he would pray. And he was killed. I believe, I didn't know about Judaism anything because I was born 1930 when Stalin just started to kill the best Jew, the famous, you know. And I didn't know. I was ashamed. My parents talked Yiddish in order for me not to understand. And when I came here, first time when I'm asking, where are you from? What's your accent? I said, I'm Jew from Russia. I don't say I'm Russian. I'm Jew from Russia. And I think, I deeply believe that my generation who survived in such terrible time because we not only lost everything, because when we came back, the remaining Hazarm, whatever, Russian, who left, they want to get us and to kill the rest of us. Doesn't matter that we were robbed completely. And since I see how many, it's of course many, you know, like relatively, of people who survived that terrible time, and the terrible situation, like I'm being hungry, being in the forest looking for some, you know, berry to eat. We survived in order to give next generation of Jew willing to be a Jew and survive and bring Jewishness, Yiddishness, Mamalush to the future generation. That we have to fight. When you fight, you survive. When you work, you survive.
Right. By the way, we're all survivors. So we are people who came from generation of generation of Jews who built after this, right? We're all here. Bruce, you had a question?
Yes. How do you see the candle of people who are survivors? Are going to be maintained. It's going to be through oral tradition. Right now, you know, it's on video. You know, Steven Spielberg has put a lot of these stories on video. And to me, with video, you kind of lack the compassion, empathy, and feeling of talking to a real person.
You have so. I would say
so
what
you're. I'm asking how.
So we ever.
How are we going to feel?
And so it's obviously, so I think that's an important question. Listen, every year we have Passover. What do we celebrate something at Passover that happened 3,340 plus years ago. So we still memorialize that we left Egypt. That's an event that happened thousands of years ago. I'm not sure if we'll have a holiday for holidays, but I think what we're doing today is exactly how you do it. You have young girls, their parents, hearing a survivor from Russia, hearing a Yid from Budapest tell his story, right? That's how we give it to the next generation. Just like we pass down our traditions and other levels, it's by hearing it. I tell my kids, and my kids have seen, I didn't get to my wife's side. My wife's, you know, tell you a funny story. My wife comes from Hungarian backgrounds. I'm all Polish. So on my first date with my wife, so I said to her, you know, as a little kid, my bubby used to always say that Poland is the best, then comes Galicia, and then it's Hungary. So my wife tells me, oh, it's funny, my grandma said, Hungary is the best, then comes Galicia, and then it comes Poland, right? But, you know, my wife's grandparents also were survivors. They were Hungarian, so it's a very different story, because Hungary got to the war much later. We heard that. My kids heard that. It's all about meetings like you have today. That's why this meeting, that's why these girls coming is so, so important. You know, they're turning bat mitzvah with the rest of their lives. They're going to remember they heard from people who were there. Yes.
Okay. In case you
Al, I'm sorry. Wait, Truth. Oh, Al's ready.
I want to answer Bruce's question. The group knows that we have a speaker's bureau. The point of the speaker's bureau is to have this personal one-on-one talks, testimony from us to the students, to the high school students. We're working on it right now. We're actually in transition. Many of the members are here. But that's how we are getting that one-on-one connection to supplement the YouTube presentation. Great movies, okay? But you're right, we do need the one-on-one. The students need to have that flesh and blood.
Right. I will also say, besides being a lawyer, I'm also a rabbi. And as a rabbi, I can tell you that besides Hashem and any other reason, if you are the more connected you are to your Judaism, at whatever level that is, the more you'll remember the Holocaust. Because your Judaism is important to you. And the Holocaust was a very important Jewish historical event. The more Judaism, just like Israel, they show that the more connected you are to Judaism, the more you care about Israel. Same thing about the Holocaust. The more you're connected to Judaism, the more you will keep Holocaust in mind in the future. But Al?
I just want to say two things. One is, it's always been a question in my mind. What happened, or why did the rabbis that were councils of the Germans in the warriors not advise the Jews to fight out, to fight and to keep themselves alive rather than be carried out?
Right.
And the other thing I want to say, and I'll listen to your answer. This morning in the Mercury was an article on the Jews acting with the Holocaust or handling their Holocaust in the background as, what's his name? That was running for president. Sanders.
Bernie Sanders.
However you take that article, please read it, because he talks about that Holocaust, when Sanders was asked by, I guess, first CNN and also by a woman in the thing, is what kind of religion does he have, he finally admitted he was Jewish and talked about his grandparents being Holocaust people and dying, I think it was in Dachau, but in Auschwitz, but I'm not sure.
Who was this woman?
This was Dr. Kreinhauer,
Charles Krauthammer.
He's a reporter. He wrote an article in today's
Mercury about that. And he, depending how you look at it, whether he's criticizing Sanders or whether he's congratulating him, but it sounds like he's criticizing him and the Jewish people to identify themselves only as Holocaust. You ask them what they are, first thing they say is they talk about the Holocaust. And I read that article as being suggesting don't identify yourself by being a Holocaust survivor, but what you do now as a person. It's interesting for that article.
What he was saying, I think, was that although Holocaust is a part of the Jewish identity, it's important that we embrace our culture otherwise, and what we've brought to society and civilization.
Not to be defined.
And, that being the key thing, rather than the Holocaust as the major event.
Yeah.
Sure. And I don't think he was criticizing Sanders one way or the other. He was talking to the Jewish people about how great we are.
So just to answer the first question, maybe I'll go, because I know the girls want to do their thing, so I'll stay around if anyone has any questions. But as far as Al's first point about fighting back against, so first of all, what is the most famous fight back against the Nazis, the rebellion? The Warsaw Ghetto. So the Warsaw Ghetto, before they decide, and you have to remember, when you're in the Warsaw Ghetto, they're going to liquidate the ghetto, but at the same time, if they liquidate the ghetto, people know, but if you fight back now, there will be immediate deaths. There's no right answer in 1943 in Poland. It was a suicide mission to fight back. But they, before they fought back, they went to Rabbi Menachem Zemba, who was the Ager Chassid, who was one of the heads of the Warsaw Jewish community before the Holocaust. And he told them to fight back. Actually, they fought back under Menachem Zemba's advice. But I'll tell you a different thing, just to answer Al's question, then I'm going to sit down just so the girls can go. In when Lithuania happened, there was no concentration camps in Lithuania. They went with Einsatzgruppen and just mowed them down. They had pits, and they mowed them down. And there were two towns. One was Kelm. Kelm was surrounded. There had been a yeshiva in Kelm, a Musar yeshiva, which is where they used to study ethics. And in Kelm, they're surrounded by Nazis and machine guns. Basically, the Polish army loses in 3 weeks, a whole army. Lithuania was just marched into, first by the Russians and later by the Nazis. They had no real methods to fight back. And basically, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Kelm Yeshiva, took them and said, said we should die as believing Jews. Let's all pray. And they said, and they were shot and they were killed. The next town over, as the Nazis did the same thing, basically they killed over 1.5 million Lithuanian, Latvian, Estonian, and on the Russian border Jews exactly in this way, just shot them into pits. The next town over, as they're rallying up the Jews, a Jew calls over a Nazi and stabs him in the heart, and then they start shooting at him. They shot the whole group. They went to the Rav of Kovna, of Kawis, Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana, who was a famous rabbi, and he asked him who was right. Should what they have done in Kelm is right? Should what they have done in the other town? The guy stabbed him. They were going to lose either way. Better to go down taking it or to use your final moments praying to God, because there's no real opportunity. So they're both right, as long as the same, if your intentions are correct, right? There are no right answers. There are no easy answers, to be honest, in the Holocaust. If the French army and the Polish army couldn't beat them, so it depends on what your intentions are. Certainly, I think that whether you're a rabbi or anyone fighting back, the consequences were very, very great. If you fought back, they killed women and children. So it's hard to know today, but I will say that there are more than one way to fight the Nazis. Certainly what we're doing today, whether it's seven children or many other people, we're all fighting Nazis, and thank you for having me.